Let me just thank you again for being here. It's been great to be with you, to get to talk with so many of you on our breaks and during meals. And let me say, I'm finishing up my first one as a young adult. Thank you guys so much for your leadership in the churches. Us young guys need fathers and mothers in the faith who can show us the way. But I want to transition. This second talk is going to be... The short version is, these young people are crazy, right? This is the part where I say, I understand. I look at them and I don't get what's going on. I ended the first talk with a story from Genesis. Isaac and Rebekah transitioning from one generation to the next. I want to begin this time with another story from the Pentateuch. This is one that is familiar to us, many of us in the churches of Christ. It's the story of Nadab and Abihu, and I've got that text printed on page one of my portion of the packet. And I'll warn you now, we're going to spend a little more time in those materials, but we're going to be kind of jumping around from page to page, so I'll do my best to direct traffic in that way. If you would, indulge me, let me just read this text, Leviticus 10, verses 1 to 5. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, put fire in them and added incense. And they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke of when he said, 'Among those who approach me, I will be proved holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored.'" Aaron remained silent. Moses summoned Mishael and Elzaphan, sons of Aaron's uncle Uziel, and said to them, "Come here, carry your cousins outside the camp, away from the front of the sanctuary." So they came and carried them, still in their tunics, outside the camp, as Moses ordered. Let me just make a couple comments on this text. First of all, this is another story of generations, right? Just now, before this, Aaron and his sons have been consecrated to the priesthood. This is not just about Aaron. It's about Aaron and his sons. And that language of fire coming out from the presence of the Lord, if we turn back to chapter 9, we've just heard it, just at the end of chapter 9. In verses 23 and 24, it says, "Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down." And my guess is, when fire came out from the presence of the Lord the second time, not as much joy, maybe falling face down again, but for a different reason, right? And we could spend time talking about what unauthorized fire is or strange fire, and, you know, there's scholars have different proposals. We've read Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, and we know that there's kind of an ethos there of there's things that are authorized and there's things that aren't. And we don't, from our cultural perspective, we don't really know what it was, but something wasn't right, and it didn't go well for them, right? And the folks who study this will say, you know, in a way, this story is an example of the principle of measure for measure, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. They offered unauthorized fire, and they were consumed by fire. There's kind of a balance there. But notice the reaction of their father. Aaron was silent. And I'm not sure why he was silent. I don't know what thoughts were going through his head. My guess is there were an unbelievable number. But when you read that, it reminds us of another biblical figure whose sons got involved in some trouble and remained silent, right? King David. And things did not go well there. In King David's case, though, he remained silent before everything played out. Aaron remained silent afterwards. And the reason I want to begin with this story is I think sometimes we wonder if something like Nadab and Abihu is going to happen to this next generation. I mean, what in the world are they doing in their lives, in the church? They just want to throw away all our heritage and they want to change everything. And sometimes we wonder if fire is going to come out from the presence of the Lord and just consume them. And presumably that would be a bad thing, but we just kind of wonder, right? Another way to say it is what I wonder if Aaron might have been thinking, what is going on with these kids? What is the deal? Well, we talked this morning about the changing face of developmental psychology and what we think about, you know, how kids are growing up. You know, one of the deals is we just aren't really expecting them to grow up as quickly as we used to. And one of the results of that is that just like college is the new high school, college can kind of become an extension of high school. Now, there was this movie that came out several years ago called Old School. And if you saw it, you might have wondered why you wasted a couple of hours. It's one of those movies that's really funny, but also crass, and so you have mixed feelings. If you haven't seen it, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. But the gist of the story is this. There's these few guys who are around age 30, and, you know, they're working, and one of the guys has a breakup in a relationship, and one of them, who sort of has a successful businessman, he decides that really the glory days of college, that's where it's at. And so he buys a house near the college in their town, and they sort of set up an unofficial fraternity that's unrelated to the school. And so they invite kids over, and they have these big parties, and the guys get involved, and one of the dudes ends up breaking it off with, I can't remember if they're married or engaged, but, you know, his relationship doesn't work out, all because they want to get back to the fun of college, right? And we see students doing that now. I mean, young adults that life is more about fun than effort sometimes, right? Have you heard the phrase, somebody saying something like this, I did my undergraduate work at, and then they fill in the blank. I don't hear that anymore. I don't hear people saying work with undergraduate. They say, I did my bachelor's degree at ACU. I did my undergrad at. But people don't talk about my undergraduate work. And my students don't seem to want work in their classes. They want to learn, but they don't want to work. Look at page 12 of your packet. One of the things that you may be wondering is, what do these people believe? I mean, they act really weird in terms of church. Do they actually believe some things that are helpful here? Page 12 is a summary from a portion of a study that was put out by the Pew Research Center. This is another group who studies research and religion and public life. And the link that's there at the bottom of the page is a very long, it's over 100 pages, of summary of a group of studies that they did on the newest generation, the ones that they call millennials, those that were born after 1980. This is a summary of just a portion of that, and I'm just going to make a couple comments about this page because I want you to have this to read at your leisure. But if you're interested in the things that they're doing, this is available online, and it's very, very interesting and helpful in terms of just understanding things. Well, you know, in this theme of what's going on with these kids, right? You look at this page, the first bullet point there, how much more tolerant of things that we might call non-traditional behaviors about marriage and parenting, how much more tolerant young adults now are than you and I were. The third bullet point, how many of them have tattoos? The fourth bullet point is about piercings, right? Those are those things that are on the outside that we see and we just don't get. We don't understand why this is such a big deal. Because for a lot of young adults, having tattoos is not about rebellion. It's about personal expression. Right? They're using their bodies as canvases to express something about themselves or sometimes to memorialize someone that has died. And we memorialize people, but we don't do it in ink on our bodies. Skip back a few pages to page 3. The page entitled Millennials Pre-9/11 and Today. The top half of that page is some comments from a book that was written, as you can see, in the year 2000. And it's a very hopeful, very optimistic evaluation of the rising generation of children at that point who are now young adults. It's really interesting because just the year after that, 9/11 happened and things changed for this group. The bottom half of the page is from a book that was just published this last year. That's a very interesting read, and I would recommend it to you highly. But notice the little table that comes from that book. 12 years ago, 90% of teenagers planned to go to college. As of 2009, 30% of teenagers didn't even graduate from high school. Many had dreams of transforming the world, and yet many face a, what he calls a quarter-life crisis at age 25, right? They're out of school, maybe they've had a couple years of work, and things just aren't turning out the way that they thought that they would. And so they're having these crises that to us seem like, I mean, this is way too early. You got a lot of life to live before you deserve to have a crisis. Okay? On the facing page there, page 4, is another selection from that book. I mentioned this morning a couple of the paradoxes. This is where I took this language from. The paradoxes of young adults today. And what I like about this table is it's both and, right? We like that young adults feel special and needed, right? We think self-esteem is a good thing. And they also act spoiled and conceited, and we're not that fond of that, right? Or look at the one at the very bottom of that table. They hunger to change the world, which is true. And they anticipate doing it quickly and easily, which I find to be also true. Related to that, and kind of moving us a little bit toward thinking again about technology, those of us that are older look at these kids and wonder, do they have any sort of attention span? They don't seem to have an attention span for life, moment to moment, right? They seem to be plugged into headphones all the time. They can't walk from point A to point B without having some music to sort of cover that time. They spend hours watching YouTube videos that last 3 minutes apiece. They multitask when they talk to their friends. They're always texting, but not very often on the phone. When I teach, you know, I want to have, you know, let students feel like they have, you know, they're participating in what we do in class. But I usually plan, you know, to use some multimedia things just because that grabs their attention. And there's a lot of really great stuff on YouTube that I use for teaching. And so I always want to ask them, you know, is it okay if I show you a YouTube clip? And they never shake their heads, ever. I mean, they're always glad. I don't know if it's just to get a break for me. They're always glad to watch something on YouTube, even if they don't know what it's going to end up at. They're just a strange group, right? I want to talk a little more, a bit more at length about technology in this young generation, because as I mentioned this morning, this is a way in which our generation and their generation is quite different. Okay, look at page 11 of the packet, please. The page is entitled Millennials and Technology. Again, millennials is a term that the Pew Group uses to describe those born after 1980. And as you glance down, a number of the bullet points there describe differences between generations on a variety of behaviors regarding technology. Okay? Just look at the things that they describe. Think about how many of these you have ever done. Right? Do you have a profile on a social networking site? That's like Facebook. But some of us do. Have you ever slept with your cell phones on or next to your bed while you were sleeping? 2 years ago, 83% of young adults said that they had. I'm betting it's even higher now. Right? Remember when, like, daylight savings time switched? You see these stories in the paper about, you know, the iPhone didn't catch daylight savings time, and so these young people were late for work because that's their alarm clock. Posting a video of themselves online. There's something important there, right? They're not posting videos. They're posting videos of themselves doing things, which 1% of the older than baby boomers generation has ever done. And yet 20 times that many of young adults. Texting while driving. Look down at the next to last bullet point. Compare with other generations, a higher percentage of millennials believes that new technology makes life easier rather than more complicated. Also, a higher percentage of millennials believes that new technology makes people feel closer to friends and family rather than more isolated, and it allows people to use their time more efficiently rather than to waste time. And that's an interesting one to me, because as I look at young adults, I see them both being efficient and also wasting a lot of time. What I see in this, as I look at this and think about the students that I teach, what I see is a near total integration of technology into their daily lives. Right? They sleep with their technology. It's always with them. Sometimes it's as though their cell phones are an extension of their arm. I mean, sort of hard to pry it off. And that's just different. Right? Some of us answer our phones while we're eating, maybe on business, but that's par for the course. Some of us answer our phones in the movie theater, but we sort of feel guilty about maybe being inconsiderate. That's pretty common with young people. Flip back a page and look at page 9. The page entitled Generations and the Technology Gap. Again, this is from the Barna Group that I mentioned before. They use the term mosaics for those that are now ages 18 to 25. The third bullet point, under where it says among their important findings, they talk, survey all the different generations about activities that many different folks use with computers and technology. Notice the things that millennials do, at least 50% of them do every week. So email and web search, which is what a lot of us do, text messaging, possibly being on Facebook, instant messaging, commenting on blogs, watching videos online, downloading music legally and illegally. And they say the only two of these activities to which less than 20% of millennials admitted doing weekly were downloading movies and viewing online pornography, and on the last, they might be lying. Right? For you, I think the most important takeaway on this page is the second bullet point in the bottom. Based on their research, they conclude that older generations, that would be us, use technology for information and convenience. Younger adults use technology to facilitate their search for meaning and connection. Okay. One very practical point there is that sometimes in churches we think, well, young people like technology, therefore we should have a really great website because that's going to help bring young people to church. I would recommend not spending a whole lot of time on that because that's not really what they're looking for. If you want to have a website, make it good, right? You don't want to push people away. Have helpful information. But young people are probably not going to spend a whole lot of time tooling around your church website, right? Make it useful. Make it practical. Rather, I think, you might talk to the young people at your church about how you could use technology to help people connect, right? And probably they're going to have a lot better ideas than you and I do, right? Which is why I'm not going to say this is what I think you should do. What I think you should do is talk to the people in your church because they know what they do. They know what their friends do, and they can help you that way. Right? We tend to think of young people as very technology savvy. Right? Like they know all these things about computers because they're on them all the time. At the beginning of the fall semester last year, I was teaching two classes of entering freshmen. And one of the things that we did was a little brief survey where I asked them to self-report about their computer usage. And the very common answer was, I feel very comfortable on the computer. What I mainly do is communicate with my friends and watch stuff on YouTube. In other words, I entertain myself and I make connections with people. They're not doing fancy programming or website design or graphics. Some of them can do that, but they know the things that they can do to connect with people. So I'd encourage you to talk to them. The last thing I want to say about technology and young people is that technology is a way that they deal with stress. That's another way that we are different from them. Look back at page 6 in your packet. It says stress, technology, and young adults. There are some helpful things on this page regarding the different kinds of stress that young people undergo and the sources of those stresses. Look at the very bottom, though, of that page. Tim Elmore says, young people tend to respond in one of two ways to being overwhelmed. One, they push back and get lost in a virtual world of online fantasy video games or a social world of texting, Facebook, and Twitter. This is a coping mechanism. They survive by escaping reality and becoming someone else. Or, option two, they respond by trying to measure up. They push themselves to be a super kid. They go online to perform, and they strive for perfection. All right, so notice, one, that Technology is involved in both of those responses. But two, I would say this is an opportunity that we have as leaders of young people in churches, right? We need to know that our young people are dealing with stress, right? Just because they are young does not mean that they are stress-free. And really, they're dealing with stresses that we don't quite get because of generational differences, okay? And I'd say this is just a brief summary. If you're interested in more of this, I'd encourage you to get a hold of this resource, this book by Tim Elmore. But what we can do is find ways to help them deal with stress, right? And just like as is the case with all adults, helping people deal with stress will quite often be very individual, right? There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to helping young people deal with stress. But as we get to know them, I think we can find ways to help them deal, to help them cope. And a lot of that's going to be talking to them and providing spaces for them to talk. Remember again how important relationship and connection is for people of this generation. And if we can help provide that, that's an opportunity not only for ministry, but also for leadership, I think, as Eddie was talking about. All right, now, the fact that there's no one-size-fits-all approach is true about helping young people deal with stress, but I would also say it's just really true about all aspects of ministry to young adults. Okay? I mentioned this morning that I have been involved in youth ministry in some different contexts. Let me just describe very briefly some of the different kinds of young adults that I've been in contact with. Okay? And this is not exhaustive. This is just to sort of invoke or evoke some people in your mind and get you to begin thinking about who are the people that you have contact with, right? I have known and been in contact with folks who are like post-college, state school, campus ministry graduates, right? I mentioned my wife is an Aggie. People like that, okay? Those kind of folks have not had theological training in school. You know, they didn't get to have Bible class, but hopefully they had really good college churches. They have already lived in the non-Christian real world because they were at schools that didn't necessarily support their Christianity. So they've been out there in a way. Okay? A lot of them know how to serve, but they may or may not know how to function in sort of a smallish church, right? Because a number of the churches that support campus ministries are a little bit bigger. I knew a girl from when I was doing youth ministry in North Carolina. She went to the University of North Carolina and went to nursing school. And she's now in Nashville nursing for Jesus, essentially. She works as a nurse at a hospital and tries to let her Christian faith inform the way that she is a nurse. Okay? So there's people like that out there. There's also those post-college Christian college grads, right? And they do have some Bible background. They've been required to take some classes. Some of them have wanted to take more. Kids like this sometimes think that they know a lot, and in ways they do, and in other ways they don't, right? Those kind of folks are well-equipped to teach Bible class. So if you have them in your churches, I'd say talk to them about if that's something they want to get involved in, and train them, lead them, help them get involved in that way. They also may not have been in a smallish church in a while, right? Because a lot of the churches in our colleges' towns are fairly good-sized. So if you're in a smallish church and you have some of those kids, that's something I would encourage you to talk to them about. Right? How do you do church in a church this size when you're used to something bigger? Okay? Unlike kids that have been in state schools, though, they may not have had as much time in what we would call the real world. They've been in a little bit of a Christian college bubble. And so they might need some help thinking about how does this play out? Right? How do you live as a Christian in the real world? Another group that I've been able to have contact with is a very different kind of kid. While we were in Indiana, our church hosted a Young Life Club. And if you know anything about Young Life, it's a parachurch, sort of broadly Protestant ministry that attempts to reach teenagers where they are. Right? One of the Young Life ideas is we don't invite them to come to us, we go to their turf. Okay? So that means you go do youth ministry in high school cafeterias and at coffee shops and football games. There's a lot of really great stuff about that. And what that resulted in our church was that we ended up ministering to a lot of kids who were very much on the margins in their high school society. They were not the kids who were the football players and the cheerleaders and in band and, you know, really involved. They were ones who, a lot of them had kind of slipped through the cracks a little bit. And now as they're growing up, they look really different from a lot of the other young adults I know. They're not really that interested in sort of thinking really broadly about the world. Right? They're pretty focused on their culture, the stuff that's going on with them. A lot of them come from very troubled families. They don't have good models of what it looks like to be a grown man or woman. And the ones that are thinking about coming to faith in Jesus, they don't often have really great visions of what that might look like. And so for them, they don't have a lot of training. They're very much in, you know, blue-collar type of jobs, which presents its own opportunities, but also its own challenges. Okay? Now, where I think you guys can come in is in your own diversity. Okay, just like there are a variety of types of young adults, different personalities, different backgrounds, different levels of training, that's the same way with you. Okay? One of the things I want to, you'll hear me come back to a couple times this afternoon, is the importance of relationship in ministry to young adults. And I think one thing that you can do as you think about how you might minister is try to find, you know, where do you match up? Where do you or other leaders in your church match up with the young people that are there? Because my guess is you can't find one person or one couple to do the young adult ministry and make all those kind of connections. It will probably need to be a group of people who will work with those young adults. Okay. So let's talk then about what does church life look like for young adults these days? Can I talk about technology and just sort of the different places that they are? But what are they doing right now in terms of church? Okay. Look at page 7 in the packet, if you would. These are two pages that, again, come from some Barna Group research. Ways that adults attend church. Okay? As you look at the left side of the page, they identify 5 different types of adults in terms of their relationships with churches. The one at the bottom is the one that we're probably most familiar with, conventionals. Adults who attend a conventional church at some point in the past month. At the top, you have at the other end, people who have not attended any kind of faith community. The intermittents are those who have come a little bit, but not that much. Homebodies in the middle, people who don't really go to conventional churches, but they might have attended a meeting of a house church. And then blenders, the fourth one there, people who had attended both. As you look over those, I would say I see young adults in all of these categories, right? Young adults make up, you know, a portion of every single one of these. But I think the one that's most interesting is the blenders. Right? Because a lot of young adults are involved in more than one kind of faith community. Okay? Notice the language that's there. Adults who attended both a conventional church and a house church during the past month. They attend a conventional church as a primary church, but many are experimenting with new forms of faith communities. And this is something that is, if you're not aware of it, it is very much on the rise right now. There are terms like simple church, organic church, house church, the new monasticism. There's all kinds of different ways that this is happening. But essentially, it's faith communities that are not traditional churches. Okay? So just one brief example. We have a group of undergraduates at ACU who, a couple years ago, under the mentoring of one of our faculty members, were looking around at the neighborhoods around ACU, and they realized that there was this one neighborhood that was kind of a historically black neighborhood, very near ACU, but one that has had almost no contact with ACU over the years. Sometimes it's been, you know, not a great relationship, but I think generally it's just sort of apathy on both sides. And they decided that if they were going to actually live out their faith, they didn't want that to just be on Sunday morning or when they go to church, but actually in the living, where they sleep at night, should be a place where they can express their faith in Jesus. And so they got a house right in the middle of this very poor community. And there's a group of 4 guys right now that live there together, but there's some other friends, both male and female, that are, you know, nearby and that come and spend time, and they minister to the people in the neighborhood. They minister to the kids. They've begun to make contacts with the local alternative high school that's right there nearby. Sometimes they go to the Missionary Baptist Church that is in that neighborhood. Right? Because I mentioned it was a historically black neighborhood. Sometimes they go there. It's a very small church, and they kind of double the population when they show up. But, you know, it's something that they enjoy. But they're finding great meaning in that expression of faith community, and they're not sure what things will look like for them 10 years from now. Right? They don't know if 10 years from now they'll be, you know, settled down and in a regular church, or will they still be doing this, or will they be doing something else? This is not an uncommon thing for young adults. Okay? Now, look at the facing page there. From the same report, different places that churched people experience God's presence. Okay? Conventional churches are at the top. House churches, we've talked a little bit about that. But these are other places, what they call marketplace churches. Right? So this might be something like Fellowship of Christian Athletes at a young level, or ministries in your workplace, Bible studies, real-time ministry events on the internet. This is not something I have taken part in. My guess is you probably haven't either, although maybe some of you have. Religious television or radio programs, faith-oriented websites, special ministry events, right? This is like the one-time worship concert, or, you know, a big trans church community service deal. Look at that bottom quote. More than one out of every five adults have been involved in two or more types of churches. I think that's especially true of young adults. Okay? So, what does that mean for us? Well, a couple things. Number one, different young adults are engaging these things in different ways. Okay? What that means is there's not a magic bullet for you if you want to get all the young adults in your community. You're not going to be able to do one kind of thing and sort of expect that to work for everybody. All right? I think there's some freedom in that, but I just want to get that out on the table. Okay? Secondly, our churches are not the only place that people are finding God. They're not the only places that people are having meaningful spiritual contacts with other people. And that's really different for us, right? I mean, most of our lives, church has been the primary venue. And maybe there's some other things that supplement that a little bit, but church is still number one. And that's not necessarily the case for these young people. Okay? I think we can be okay with that, but we got to not be afraid of that reality. Okay? What I think we can do then is try to make our churches even more meaningful places where they can encounter God. Places that they want to come because they find that connection. When I talk to young people and hear about their spiritual lives, the language that so often gets used is, I want to connect with God. All right? They don't talk in the same ways that maybe we have about wanting to please God or wanting to live a certain kind of life. They want to feel connected. And if you're thinking, well, that kind of sounds like how they are with their friends, I would say you're exactly right. Right? Those desires for connection are not just human to human. They are also human and divine. And so if we can make our churches places where young people connect with God, that is going to be very helpful to them. It's going to be a great ministry. I can't promise you it's going to mean that they all come and place membership, right? Because they don't necessarily do that in the same way that we do. But they can find ways to get involved. And I think that will look different, right, in different churches and with different folks. For some, it'll be about worship. Others, it'll be about good preaching. Others, it'll be about service. Others, it'll be about spiritual practices and disciplines, right? But we can make our churches important places for young adults to connect with God. Probably won't be the important place, right, but one of many important places. When I went to ACU for my interview, I got to ask the faculty, you know, whatever question I wanted. And I asked them, tell me about the students that are here. And Randy Harris, who some of you know, said, you know, they're not real bright, but they are more spiritual at their age than any of us were. Right? They love Jesus, and they are concerned about spirituality. And I have found that to be true on both sides, right? They're not always real bright. But they want to make Jesus the center of things. They want to make their spiritual lives the center of things. And I think we can try to make our churches places where they can live that out. Okay. Now, you may have noticed that I have slightly shifted to a little bit more hopeful tone, right? It's not just that these people are crazy, right? There are good things that are happening, right? They are interested in spiritual things. They are attending church, even if it's not in the ways that we're the most comfortable with, familiar with. If you look at page 10 of the packet, on the page entitled Religion and the Millennials, you'll see some other things that give me hope. I hope they give you a little bit of hope. The first bullet point set there says that millennials are less likely than their predecessors to claim an affiliation with any particular faith. But, on the next bullet point, there are ways that they look less religious, but it's actually kind of like our generations were when we were young. Right, some of these longitudinal studies that track things over time, they can look back and say, oh, this kind of sounds like how the baby boomers were when they were 20 or 25. Right? So they look less religious to us, but they're not necessarily less religious than prior generations of young people. Right? And the third bullet point there shows that they still believe in some things that we would find to be important, right? That there is life after death, that there are heaven and hell, that there are miracles, that angels and demons exist. And for those in the last bullet point who are religiously affiliated, they're still strong, just like our generations were. There may be less of them, but they're still strong. Okay? Many of them do care about religion. There are a bunch that don't, right? I mean, that's just true. But a lot of them really do, and we can find ways to help them express that well. This is where I want to come back to that book that I mentioned in the first session, Unchristian. Look again at pages 13 and 14, right? Where that book connects with me in the reality of dealing with young adults is that the book wants to make the point that for outsiders, Jesus is the measure of the church, right? And they find fault with the church for not measuring up to their perception of Jesus. I see a similar focus on Jesus in the insiders, right? The kids who do care about religion. And so the things that these authors have to say, I think, can be helpful to us because they provide alternatives to us. They say, this is how people sometimes think about the church in some particular ways, but this is what our opportunity might be going forward. Let me just give those to you on each of these 6 points. Okay? So they say, concerning the apparent hypocrisy of the church, instead of appearing to say one thing and then living entirely differently, we have the opportunity to be transparent about our flaws and to act first rather than talking first. Concerning this focus on getting people saved, they say instead of being, you know, seemingly insincere and just wanting to get a bunch of converts, and if it doesn't work, you move on to the next guy, we can try to cultivate relationships with people who are not in the church, and to cultivate environments where people can be deeply transformed by God. All right, now number 3 is touchy, right? The church, if the world thinks that the church is anti-homosexual, they think that we show contempt for gays and lesbians. Sometimes we do. What we have the opportunity to do in this new world is to show compassion and love to all people, regardless of their lifestyle. Now, we might differ about what we call people to out of that compassion and love, but we have the opportunity to be compassionate to people who are struggling with all kinds of things. They think we're too sheltered, right? So instead of coming across, as much as we can control, that is boring or unintelligent or out of touch with reality, we can really try to engage our culture, inform ourselves about it, and try to think deeply and respond deeply to real issues that people face, right? I said this morning that young people today are very well suited to helping us think about pop culture, right, and issues that are happening in culture, right? That's a place that we can employ the young people in our churches to help us do that. How are we going to think in the world? Right? Concerning politics, instead of displaying ourselves as being highly motivated by political agendas, we can display a persona of respecting people, of thinking biblically about complex topics, and helping find solutions and not just pointing out problems. And finally, they say, concerning being judgmental, seemingly, instead of acting in pride and quickly finding fault in others, we can show grace by finding good in others and by seeing their potential to be followers of Christ. I think all of those kinds of actions are things that would be meaningful to the young adults in our congregations, and they're things that they could help us with because that's the world that they live in. Okay? And you'll notice how many of those alternatives that they said implied things like relationship and conversation. Right? And honestly, I think that's one of the best things that we as older leaders can do with the young adults in our churches. As you leave today, I would encourage you to do everything you can to build relationships with the young people in your churches. Some of that may feel kind of awkward and a little bit overly intentional, but find ways to talk with them about their lives, about the challenges they face, their struggles, their successes. Right? They thrive on relationships. And when we sequester young people in young adults groups, I think we miss an opportunity, right? Those can be good, but also find ways to involve them in intergenerational leadership and ministry and fellowship, ways where you as older folks, where we as older folks, can connect with them. Okay. I want to close today with just one sort of practical nuts and bolts kind of issue. I know that some of you are troubled by the young people who have been in your congregation in the past and are no longer. Okay. Obviously, I can't explain to you why those people might have left. My guess is they had a number of different reasons. You've heard some things today about why young people don't necessarily connect with churches in traditional ways, or struggle maybe to find connections in churches. This is what I would tell you. Thanks to technology, you are not stuck in a state of ignorance. Okay? I want you to turn to page 15, the last page we'll look at in this packet. This page is entitled Ways to Solicit Anonymous Feedback Online. What I've given you there are three different ways that you can, I mean, this is just generally true, but in the scenario of losing young people, these are ways that you can get in touch with them if you have email addresses for them and invite them to help you learn about what's going on with them. Okay? The last two, SurveyMonkey and Zoomerang, those are both website-based survey tools. Google Forms, is Google has just a number of these tools that are available. And you can create, with that one, a little form that you could email to someone or to, let's say, a group of 40 or 50 people. And you can create questions, right? You could create multiple choice questions. You could create true-false questions, right? I left this church because the worship was terrible. I mean, I don't know. You could set it up however you want. But you can especially ask open-ended questions, right? You could set it up to say things like, what did you find meaningful while you were in our church community? What did you find lacking? What do you find meaningful in your new church community? Right? And then something like, if you had the opportunity to speak to our elders and staff in an anonymous way, what would you tell them? And by using one of these tools, that's actually what they're getting to do. Okay. Now, you may be thinking, I have no idea how to use one of these. What I would say is, you've got young people in your church, use them. Let them help you because they can set this stuff up for you in a heartbeat. If you have contact information for folks who have left and you want to know why, you can create ways of finding that information out. And of course, it's up to them to share. But hopefully, you could gain some information and some anonymous perspectives from folks who have chosen to leave. As unfortunate as that is, that may be helpful moving forward. One more thing about people leaving and technology. If you're on Facebook and you're friends with young adults who leave your church, don't defriend them, right? Don't burn the relational bridge. Let them do it. If they want to do it, don't you do it, right? Leave the door open, okay? If I had to sum up what I have wanted to say to you today, I would say this, right? Young adults are really different than we are in some pretty fundamental ways. And yet in other ways, they are the same, right? Some of that's cultural, but a lot of it's theological. I mean, they are children of God made in His image. They are redeemed by Christ. They are filled with the Holy Spirit. And we share some very deep foundational traits. Young people today desire relationship in ways that we do and yet in other ways that we don't. They don't always know how to express that desire really well. And so I would encourage you to reach out to them in a very legitimate, honest, two-way relationship, right? Share your lives with them just as you ask them to share their lives with you. Young people today have huge abilities in service and in leadership. And so I'd encourage you to give them opportunities to do those things. Be ready to catch them when they fall, steer them when they get a little bit off track, and let them fly when they spread their wings. They know technology, and so get them on your side. Let them help you. And finally, pray for them without ceasing. Just as you pray for the rest of your flock, pray for the young adults in your congregations and ask God to help you to know how to minister to them. Because I've got some ideas, but God is the one who is truly wise. Thanks for your time today.